Okay, let's start. Today's lecture is number 2 on May 10th, Introduction to Set Theory, Probability, and Statistics. Today, I apologize for Saturday's problem. I was not aware of the change. That's my mistake. I'm having trouble keeping up with all the Japanese email. It takes a very long time to read and figure out what's going on, so I look at the subjects, and if it's not obvious that it applies to me, I put it in a stack and get back to it later. And at this point, I'm about 250 behind. I'm sorry about today. I fell asleep in the afternoon. I haven't been feeling well all day. So let's get going. I'm going to try and keep the lectures segments to about 20 minutes each and upload them as I go along. So today I want to talk about set theory, probability, and statistics. Set theory and probability are linked to each other because we use the mathematics of sets to understand events, the things that can happen. Things that can happen can be complicated. And in order to model those complications mathematically, we use the ideas or the basic operations of sets. Probability itself is again a mathematical modeling technique, which is fundamental to statistics, which pretty much all of our students use, as well as to risk analysis, finance theory, and things like that, as well as the economics of insurance, and so on. So let's look at what probability is. Please go to the second slide. After this, I think I'm just going to say ping. Last time I didn't do that, and that's probably annoying. I will be asking about that later. So the introduction to probability. Probability is a numerical assessment of the likelihood of events, how frequently they seem to happen to human beings. It's a mathematical model, and it obeys some convenient mathematical laws that allow us to calculate probabilities. And more important to people who are not born as calculators, it's easy to program computers to do these calculations, or at least those computers have already been programmed. Probability is useful in understanding rational behavior. If two actions, A and B, both result in the event 1,000 yen profit, but with action A, the result seems more likely, or in probability terms, we say it has higher probability than with action B, then it's rational to choose action A, if only one of the two actions is possible. Of course, if there are other actions that also pay 1,000 yen profit, then again, you would probably pick the one that has the highest probability of yielding the profit. This is in fact what we call an axiom of Lawrence Savage's theory of expected utility. You may have studied expected utility in an economics class where we simply multiplied probabilities times utilities or probabilities times profits in the case of a firm, but we can also use this as a definition of rationality. In this sense, the economic theory of rationality is somewhat circular. We define rationality by the axioms, but we claim they're obviously rational in some undefined way. I think it's reasonable to say that we would expect that people who are trying to make a profit, if they are faced with uncertainty, they would pick the way of that has the highest likelihood of yielding the profit, as long as the profit from all of the possibilities are equal. Of course, if the profits are unequal, then we need a way to trade off between profit, a higher profit if you win, and the higher probability of winning. And that's exactly what expected utility does for us. It provides a way of evaluating how much the profit is worth to us in terms of lower probability of achieving the higher profit. But we're not going to worry about that here. If you want to know about that, you can take an economics course or a theoretical finance course where these things are discussed in detail. What I want to point out now is that this kind of circularity is true of any set of axioms. We use the axioms because they help us to define the behavior or the situation that we're talking about in ways that we can analyze mathematically. But we also want those axioms to somehow correspond to the reality that we're trying to analyze. And so we often run into this situation where economists talk about rationality and they don't acknowledge the fact that their definition of rationality is in fact utility maximization. I think this is a good definition for many purposes, but I admit that it's not the only definition that's possible. And so you need to be careful when we use words like rationality in the context of economics or perhaps business, because people may be using it in a technical sense and you may be understanding in a different sense. People frequently think that it's irrational to commit crimes, and in some sense that is, but in the case of economics, we can analyze whether it's rational or not by looking at the expected utility of committing the crime and getting away with it, and the expected utility of committing the crime and getting arrested and perhaps sent to prison and not getting any profit from it. And then we can balance the two by using probabilities. Whether you like that or not, that is one way to think about the idea of committing crimes. So this is another example of using axioms to try to put some constraints on the mathematics that we use in order to model certain aspects of reality. Ping. We use probability in socioeconomic planning for many things. I'm not going to try and give you an exhaustive list, but I do want to remind you that these are important concepts to pretty much anybody in this department. We use it in risk analysis. We use it in the foundations of modern finance theory, especially when we're talking about derivatives. We use it in the economics of investment and insurance, which is a similar kind of analysis to finance theory, but it's adapted to the needs of the field of economics. And most important, probability theory is the foundation of statistical inference, and so it's the basis for most empirical work that tries to understand causality. We can, of course, do statistical work without probability theory, but that kind of statistics is simply descriptive. It doesn't really help us understand what we're doing. Ping. So, where do these numbers come from? I said a probability is higher than another, and so that implies quantitative measurement and therefore numbers. Where do they come from? There are three basic ways where we can measure the probability of some type, of an event of some type empirically. We can count the frequency with which it is observed in a repeated context and compare it with the frequency of occurrence of that context, and assume that this relative frequency is a law that holds whenever that situation arises. So to give a concrete example, we can think about tossing a coin, which is a standard way of giving even chances to both sides. We see this in sporting events, for example. Of course, Japanese and maybe other Oriental societies are less likely to use a coin toss and more likely to play Jonkin or something like that. And Americans have their own variation on that, which children usually call 1-2-3 shoot, and that's based on the number of fingers, and one side gets odd, the other side gets even. But tossing a coin is a physical manifestation of even chances because the coin is very symmetrical. There's a little bit of difference, but we would expect that unless something has been done to the coin, it's as likely to come up heads as tails. And so the events that we're interested in are the coin falling heads up and the coin falling tails up. It's easy to imagine repeating this situation many times to find out if the coin is fair by counting the number of times it comes up heads, the number of times it comes up tails, and if those are equal, then we would say the coin is fair. and we would expect that if we flip it again, either side could win. Ping. Another way we can get numbers for probabilities is by looking at symmetry. And I've already mentioned that the coin is fair if it obeys the symmetric law of probability, that it's equally probable that heads will come up and that tails will come up, and that we might deduce this from the physical properties of the coin. Another example is the common six-sided die, which is a cubical shape, and we assume that the material inside of it is uniform. The dots themselves don't really add or subtract any weight, and so we would expect that if we roll the die with some amount of force, that would be enough to pretty much give equal probability of any of the sides coming up. Of course, you can imagine that a person who is particularly skilled at throwing the die might be able to predict which side is going to come up, but normally if you throw the die with some force and bounce it off some wall or other barrier that causes it to spin in various ways, then the probability of it coming up is pretty much the same for any face, and so any of the numbers would be. On the other hand, the sum of the number of dots on two dice is not symmetric. If you've ever played a game like craps or any other game that requires two dice, you know that the number two as the sum of 1 plus 1 comes up very infrequently compared to the number 7, which comes up quite a bit. It's not a majority of times, but it's perceptibly more than the numbers 2 or 12. On the other hand, the number of, or the pair of numbers of dots is symmetric because each die is symmetric. If we consider this correctly, that is, as ordered pairs, so that 1-2 is not the same as 2-1. Now, in most cases, we have white die with black dots, and how do you tell the difference between the dice? So imagine one is blue and one is red, and then we can say that we always list the red one first. And so in that way, each die is symmetric, and so the pairs are going to be symmetric, and we'll talk about calculating this later. The third possible way of measuring the probability of an event is subjectively. If we observe someone who we believe to be a rational actor who chooses to bet on event A rather than event B, although we know that they are equally profitable, we infer that the actor assesses higher probability for A than for B. So if somebody chooses to bet that a particular football team will win as opposed to another one in the same game, then we would assume that, assuming that you pay, say, 1,000 yen if you win, or if you lose, and you receive 1,000 yen if you win, then we would expect that this person believes that his team is more likely to win. Now, there are other reasons why somebody might do that, but if we assume they're only interested in the profit, then they're going to bet on the team that they think is more likely to win. We say that such an agent has subjective probabilities, and the agent may not be able to always assess those probabilities, but there are ways we can find out what their probability is by changing the odds in terms of the payoffs. If we say you have to pay twice as much when you lose as win, if the agent still takes the bet that they're going to win, we can assess that the probability of winning is about twice the probability of losing, and so this increased probability trades off against the decreased profitability. So, in this way, we can think about agents who are very rational in the sense that they have numerical assessments of probabilities. We can also deduce it to some extent from their behavior. We can estimate it if we have enough data. Individual humans, it turns out, are not very good at making such assessments. They not only have high variance, but they also tend to be significantly biased. Nevertheless, in many cases, we have to make decisions that mean that we face different probabilities depending on what we do, and we still have to make an assessment for that. And it turns out to be useful to use expected utility theory, which requires these probabilities. It does turn out that averaging assessments over many individuals tends to reduce both bias somewhat and also variance, which is quite dramatic. Ping. Now, in probability, we don't care about where the assessments come from as far as the mathematics goes. We just calculate according to some rules. So we may not think that agents are very good at assessing probabilities subjectively, but once we have those assessments, then we just use them and we can calculate with them. And this is part of the convenience of mathematics that I've been insisting on the whole time, that once you have these numbers or other mathematical objects, you can work with them without really caring whether you believe in them very much or not. And in fact, the whole idea of statistics is that after doing these calculations, we can look at the numbers that come out and decide whether we believe the theory that we started with by looking at the numbers that come out at the end and deciding whether we like those or not. When we are applying probability to decision theory or to statistical study, we need to make some assumptions about the existence and stability of the probabilities across trials. These assumptions are derived from some domain of knowledge. As long as the assumptions obey the laws of probability, probability theory can't help you anymore in choosing good assumptions. It can only rule out the impossible or inconsistent assumptions. So, for example, physics, or more precisely mechanics, tells us that the probability of the die coming up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6 is equally likely for any of those numbers. The probability of the coin being flipped coming up heads or tails is equally likely given the symmetry of the coin. So our knowledge of the behavior of symmetric objects that have been that are tumbling and are doing so fairly chaotically or randomly, we know that we can't predict them very well, and in fact our best bet is to predict equal likelihood of any of the possible outcomes. This domain-specific process I will call the data-generating process. Once we know what a data-generating process is, we can decide what assumptions we like about its probabilities. If we're very lucky, we may be able to measure historical frequencies, as I mentioned, and get a more precise and hopefully accurate measurement of probabilities. Ping. The rules of probability are based on set functions and set operations. Events are modeled as sets. These allow definition of rules for combining events logically. A probabilistic model is a function which gives a numerical value to certain sets and obeys certain rules for the values that we assign to combined sets. These models are rarely unique. So, for example, you might have a model of a die that is symmetric, but in fact, historically, we know that some people cheat and they drill into the die through a hole, for example, and they place a weight near that hole. Then they cover it up again with whatever color of material the die is made out of, and they paint the dot again. And that particular side is more likely to fall down because it's heavier. Such loaded dice or weighted dice do not satisfy the model that we have in mind, and we would reject the probabilistic model if we of symmetric outcomes if we rolled that die many times. So there are usually many models that fit a particular situation, and later we'll talk about how statistics can be used to determine which models we like best. ping. So, for example, suppose we want to choose the chairman or chairwoman of a committee. This committee has 6 members: Anne, Bob, Carol, Don, Ed, and Frank. Nobody really wants to be the chairman. Nobody really hates the idea, and so they all decide it's okay to choose by lottery. Anne happens to have a 6-sided die with her and proposes the rule that each person has a number. Anne's number is 1, Bob's is 2, Carol's is 3, Don is 4, Ed's is 5, and Frank's is 6. Rolling the die will generate a number, and that corresponding person becomes chair of the committee. We intuitively think that with this procedure, each person can become chairman 1/6 of the time. Although we don't have to choose this as the probability, it's convenient and symmetric, and it's reasonable given the symmetry of the die. Now, and becoming chair is the way we describe a certain event in words. As a set, we describe it as the set containing just Anne. It has the curly brackets that indicate that this is a set with only one member. We don't just say Anne is the outcome, if we're going to be mathematical about it. Another event of some interest is the event that Anne or Carol becomes the chair, which we describe as bracket Anne, comma, Carol, bracket. And we can describe that in words as the chair is female. So this, in some sense, this event that the chair is female is somewhat complicated. It depends not only on the fact that Anne and Carol are both in the set, in the event, but it also depends on the fact that none of the others, Bob, Don, Frank, or Ed, is female. So this is a pretty complicated event in the sense of, if we wanted to verify that our description, the chair is female, is descriptive of the event Anne, Carol, we would have to do a fair amount of checking. And there may be other ways to describe the same event. For example, a sexist way of describing it would be the chair wears high-heeled shoes. Men don't usually wear high-heeled shoes, although we might say we should check, and it's not necessarily true that either of the women wears high-heeled shoes, but that might be the case, and it might be a way to describe that event. Other classical sexist descriptions would be the chair wears a dress, or the chair has long hair. Any of these could be untrue, however. And so the set theoretic description of the list Anne and Carol in curly brackets is the most precise and most mathematically accurate. And it allows us to work with this in a way that the verbal descriptions may not. So I'm going to stop here and go on and talk about probability in a minute.